Georgia's DBHDD has an urgent health warning. One of every 10 counterfeit pills contain fentanyl, a powerful and very deadly drug. Pills from friends or dealers are unsafe, and one pill can cause an overdose. More info at opioidresponse.info.
Thanks for listening to the Political Rewind podcast. Be sure to like and follow us and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks, as always, to all of you out there who are listening to the show today. I want to get right to introducing the panel and start discussing the topics at hand. We're joined, as we usually are on Fridays, by the AJC legend, Jim Galloway. Jim Galloway, veteran political reporter and then columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And Jim, as I've said on this show before, and as you well know, when we began Political Rewind as a one-day-a-week show some 9 years ago, you were, in fact, patient zero. You were the first person to be on the show with me, and here we are 9 years later, and you know how much I've loved our conversations. Jim?
Thank you very much, and the title is former AJC legend.
But
let me just say, Bill, you know, when politicians find themselves in a difficult situation, often they are advised simply to declare victory and move on. And I think 9 years of truth telling constitutes a victory. So yeah, congratulations there.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Jim. I have to next introduce, with a bit of embarrassment, Anthony Michael Kreis, a professor of law at Georgia State University. Anthony, I have no idea why in the opening, the headlines or billboards, as NPR calls them, I misnamed you as Andrew. You are definitely Anthony Michael Kreis, and my apologies to you. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Good morning, Bill. It's always great to be here, and no worries about that.
Okay. Tanya Washington is with us from Georgia State University as well. Hi, Tanya. How are you doing today?
I am wonderful, and I just want to echo James' statement. This is 9 years on the air, telling truth, speaking truth to power is an unmitigated victory. So congratulations, and thanks for having us.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. And Fred Smith. Fred, you've been on the show for a very long time, too. Tanya and Anthony joined us a bit more recently than you did. But Fred, professor of constitutional law at Emory University. Fred, we've turned to you many times over the years to talk to us about constitutional law. And we're going to talk about it again today when we get to where the Supreme Court stands in some crucial cases. Hi.
Well, it's an absolute honor to be here. It always is, but it is especially an honor to be here today. And I want to say to Jim, once a legend, always a legend. That is true of you, and that is very much true of Bill.
Well, Fred, we're not going to start with the Supreme Court because the cases we've been all eagerly anticipating still have not been released. So I do want to talk about them in a few minutes and what the implications of a couple of these cases are. But I would turn to you. You clerked for Sonia Sotomayor at the Supreme Court. So I thought it'd be interesting to get your take on how they stage these final rulings. For instance, Dobbs last year, which shook up the entire world by overturning Roe v. Wade. Now we wait to hear about LGBTQ rights as opposed to free speech. We wait to hear about affirmative action in college admissions. And we're at the end of the month. How is this staging? Does it take place?
Sure. So some people don't believe me when I say this, but it's the absolute truth. They release the opinions when they're ready. And they try to make sure that they get everything out by the end of June. And so very, very rarely will it go into July. So they have this self-imposed deadline that they want everything out by the end of June. The reason why sometimes things take longer is because when they're separate writings, someone might have, you know, what they think is their perfect majority opinion, but then the concurrence comes, or the dissent comes, or, you know, someone is saying, well, in order to get my vote, actually, I need you to change this, and someone else pushes back against that. And so you're really trying to kind of make sure that everyone who is signing onto that opinion is happy, and that you've been appropriately responsive to things that are in the concurrences and the dissents. And in rare occasions, sometimes someone will write a concurrence or a dissent that ultimately becomes the majority, because when people read it, they say, actually, that's the one I want to join. I'm now persuaded, right? And that kind of can set things back. So separate writings and just really kind of making sure that every person who's in an opinion feels comfortable with everything that's in it. Sometimes that just takes a while. When all of that happens, then they release. The reason, though, why you see these big ones at the very end of June is because that's their self-imposed deadline. And so they kind of just have to they have to get it out there. And so today and tomorrow, you know, we'll hopefully see, you know, 303 Creative, the student loan case, and affirmative action.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're going to get to those in a little while on the show. But let's do this. Jim, I'd like to talk about some state issues for a few minutes and start with you on this. We now know that yesterday, Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger was interviewed by federal prosecutors who are part of Jack Smith's team, the special counsel's team, that have had two mandates, one which they've already taken action on, indicting Donald Trump for his mishandling of presidential documents. But the other part of their mandate, of course, has been to investigate efforts to overturn the 2020 election and to determine whether there was actual criminal wrongdoing there. Raffensperger is an important person to the feds, since he's the one who took the infamous phone call in which Donald Trump says, "Find me enough votes to win Georgia." Jim,
right? We don't have any details of what he was asked or what his replies were, but that kind of that I think that hardly needs to be guessed at, given the extent of that tape. I found that one of the more illuminating things out of the AJC piece was that the federal investigators had also talked to the state director of elections, who is now with the Public Safety Training Council, I believe, but so there are more people on their list than Raffensperger. And I would, for instance, I would assume, I don't know for a fact, but I would assume that that conversation between Mark Meadows and the inspection that he was doing in Cobb County probably came up. So it's a very interesting intersection. We were talking about Venn diagrams before we went on the air, but it's a wonderful kind of indication of the intersection that's building between the federal investigation and Fani Willis's.
I think that's a good point, Anthony. We know, of course, that Raffensperger's already been called before the grand jury that Fani Willis, the special grand jury that she had impaneled over a year ago now. By the way, we should also say, Anthony, that while Raffensperger has been interviewed by the feds, that would be a precursor to the potential that they will call him before the grand jury, right?
Yeah, so it certainly seems to be the case that Jack Smith's investigation, at least on the January 6th front, is picking up some steam. And I think it's important, too, to realize that in the grand jury proceedings in D.C., there's been a lot of focus on the Nevada fake electors and a lot of the mischief that was happening there. And so you can, you know, draw your own conclusions, but there's certainly a parallel, right, between the kinds of things that are happening in D.C. in the focus on Nevada and some of the other electors, fake electors, and some of the questions that the investigators surely asked Brad Raffensperger about here, in addition to not just the infamous phone call, but whatever other contacts the Trump campaign had with his office, which we know there were multiple attempts to connect Raffensperger and Trump before that phone call actually happened. We know that there was some contact between Trump and the senior investigator in the office. So there's certainly a lot more there, and there's a lot of information that I'm sure that they wanted to draw out from him and also compare to some of these other states so that maybe a broader narrative might be crafted as to, you know, the 40,000 foot level view of the attempt or alleged attempt to defraud the United States and overthrow the election.
Tanya, of course, the Raffensperger people and the feds are not going to talk publicly about what happened in this interview, but the Secretary of State's office did put out a statement in which it said, quote, Georgia is a national leader in election security, integrity, and access. Failed candidates, I love that expression, and their enablers have peddled false narratives about our elections for personal gain for a long time, and the voters of Georgia aren't buying it. Tanya?
Yeah, and I think that kind of characterizes Raffensperger's perspective on the heroic role that he played in making sure that Georgia's elections and results remained unimpeded by the efforts of those wrongdoers, bad actors, et cetera. And Fani has made clear that she's moving forward and she is not going to change course based on the federal indictment. So we shall see soon enough.
Jim, we should also point out that as this case looking at the efforts to overturn the election moves forward in the special counsel's office, Rudy Giuliani came in and gave voluntary testimony. His lawyers emphasized that about whatever his role might have been in perpetrating these notions of fraud in the election, which, of course, we know aren't true. But that also suggests, I think, that Jack Smith and his team are moving ever closer to making some decisions about whether indictments are coming.
Yeah, and it's not clear. Maybe somebody on the panel here has more information on that. I'm not sure. Was Giuliani under oath at that point? And I'm not sure. Was it before a grand jury? I don't think it was.
No. He was interviewed. We don't know whether he was under oath, but the stories report he was interviewed by federal prosecutors in New York City, and it was called essentially an amicable conversation. So, Fred, we don't know precisely what that was about, but we do know that Rudy Giuliani was one of the people who seemed to have some involvement in this scheme to identify fake electors, alternate electors, in swing states like Georgia, to have them available in the event that Mike Pence went along with the plan to not recognize the Biden electors to step in and elect Trump president of the United States, Fred.
Yeah, so this very clearly overlaps quite a bit with the investigation happening right here in Fulton County. And so it'll be interesting to see the degree of cooperation going forward, which one will kind of take precedent, right? I mean, obviously the Fulton County investigation has been going at a faster clip, not to say fast clip, but faster clip than this federal investigation. On the question of whether Giuliani was under oath, even if he wasn't, making intentionally false statements to a federal agent is a crime, right? So even though it wouldn't necessarily be a perjury as such, it would nonetheless violate the law.
Thank you for that, Jim.
Yeah, I think we would be remiss if we did not mention that Giuliani was at that famous December 2021 state Senate hearing in which he basically accused two Fulton County election workers of stealing and maneuvering to falsify votes, and basically, which was the start of making their lives hell on earth.
Yeah, Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman, her mother, who testified before the January 6th committee, and I think became well-known nationally because of the horrible, horrible way in which their lives were upended when they were falsely accused of somehow trying to put fake ballots into the Fulton County election system. Anthony, as long as we're talking about the election, I want to go to the case that the Supreme Court has ruled on that everyone was looking forward to seeing, independent state legislature theory, which Republicans posited that state courts should have no role in adjudicating matters when a legislature decides things about federal elections, so congressional lines, for example. And Anthony, I mentioned this on the show yesterday, and of course the court said, no, we're not buying that. That is not going to be the law of the land. And I mentioned on the show yesterday that had the court gone the other way, had this been in this independent state legislature theory been in place in 2020, it would be possible, it would be likely in Georgia that the state legislators, the Republicans who'd been urged by Trump to not accept the victory of Joe Biden, could have on their own decided to, in fact, give the state to Trump to get electors who were Trump electors in place. And the state courts would have had no right to intervene. Now, that's hypothetical. It didn't happen. And it's not going to happen thanks to the ruling of the courts in the future. Yes, Anthony?
Well, I think there's a couple of different layers to that, right? So on the one hand, it's true that the argument was that there would be no role for state courts to intervene and impose state constitutional law restrictions in these federal elections. Now, in 2020, though, right, that would not mean that Governor Kemp could not veto an attempt to overturn the election, right? So if the legislature brought themselves back into special session and attempted to undo things, the procedural safeguards of the gubernatorial veto would still be in place. And even Justice Thomas acknowledged that in his dissent in the case. But I think it's also important that the other constitutional principles would also attach, right? That there's a real question about equal protection and what implications there would be for equal protection of the laws by just reversing an election. You know, there are other federal statutory laws that would come into play. So I don't think it would be the case that the legislature could just run roughshod over whatever the will of the public was as expressed in the election. On the other hand, that was the argument, right? That many folks, including Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, people who are testifying here in December 2020 before the special committee in the Senate, they were arguing that. So, you know, I think that, again, the theory, the doctrine as presented to the Supreme Court had many layers. It could have gone in many different directions. I think there were other safeguards that would have been in place, but it certainly was, in my view, a very dangerous theory that could have overly empowered a legislature to just ignore the will of the people, or to at least avoid some of the regular constitutional processes that we've come to understand to be part of how state constitutionalism works, how law works more broadly.
Tanya?
Yeah, I think what's important about this decision is it kind of reinforces the idea that our system of government is characterized by a system of checks and balances at the state level and at the federal level. And I think that is an important feature of our democracy. And I was very pleased with the decision, because I think it could have had disastrous consequences for the upcoming presidential election, given all of the changes that legislatures across the United States have made since the last presidential election.
Fred, we should also point out, though, that even in his writing of the majority opinion, the Chief Justice did in fact leave room for federal courts to have a deeper involvement in what happens in with state legislatures, right?
Sure, right. So generally speaking, I think that when lines are being drawn by state legislatures, and generally when these kind of very partisan political actors are in control of our elections, that's something we tolerate to some extent. But when they violate the law, right, we want courts to be able to say so, right? And so the United States Supreme Court affirmed that state courts continue to have their ability to say so. But they also affirm their own ability as federal courts if they see a state kind of go way over the line, right? They sort of left that for another day. So they kind of preserved the state Supreme Court's ability to interpret their own state law, but they also reserved their role in interpreting federal law.
Finish.
Obviously today, these days, judges aren't the most popular. The Supreme Court isn't the most popular, but neither are legislatures when it comes to their role in undermining democracy as well, right? And so, they preserved, they tried to make sure that each lane was properly preserved.
So Anthony, if I got it right, an example of what Fred's talking about is that another ruling of the Supreme Court this session was in the case of Alabama's redistricting, in which Alabama failed to draw a second congressional district that would have had a majority black voters in it. And the Supreme Court said it was incorrectly drawn and they had to go back and redo it. So there is an example of the federal court, I think, the ultimate federal court, stepping in a positive way to remedy what was a situation that disenfranchised some black voters, yes?
I think the Supreme Court has pretty much winnowed away at the Voting Rights Act so much that, yes, the Alabama case, I think, for liberals was a real victory. But at the same time, there's not much left of the Voting Rights Act left after the Roberts Court has, systematically dismantled it and, chipped away at it for years. But I do think that there are, important principles here. One is that a lot of this really is up to Congress. Right. This is we have a very oftentimes is particularly in June because of the nature of the Supreme Court calendar. We have a jurist-centric view of the world. Right. We think about courts as being central to safeguarding democratic rights. But it is the Voting Rights Act, a law passed by Congress that required the outcome in the Alabama case. In terms of partisan gerrymandering, again, a lot of the focus has been on state Supreme Courts, and many state Supreme Courts have heard these cases, and they're important institutions, to be sure. But Congress could come back and pass a law that bans partisan gerrymandering in congressional districts. So I do think it's important to see where the victories are for folks who see them as victories and savor them, and that's great. But to also look at this in a more kind of, I think, 40,000 foot level view of how over time these rights have been eroded and chipped away at. And at the same time, also understand that courts aren't the end all be all, that there is a role for the legislative process to play out here as well.
Yeah, when the story of this era is written and we try to understand why we have come to the brink when it comes to democracy in the United States, the Supreme Court had been placing itself in a position, and it still may be, but certainly had been placing itself in a position where it would have had a very unsavory role in how that story was told. Similarly to how, when we think about Reconstruction, we think about the United States Supreme Court's implication in the end of Reconstruction. And those are for the very reasons that Anthony said, for the dismantling of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, for allowing partisan gerrymandering to go forward unobstructed, and even all the way back to Citizens United. And so the Roberts Court really had kind of really been on this trajectory in the light of history of being on a really unsavory path. I think that this term, they complicated that story and may have redeemed themselves a bit.
I thank you for that. Jim, before we get to a break, you and I go back, well, to a day we as reporters when before the Supreme Court nullified preclearance of the way in which a map in a given state was drawn by partisan actors drawing lines in their favor, we remember how we would wait to get rulings from the courts on whether or not a given map in Georgia got preclearance from the Department of Justice as being fair and representative of the population. The court threw out preclearance, we know. As Fred pointed out, it's still possible. The court says partisan gerrymandering is perfectly fine, which can allow at times for drawing lines that there are some questions as to whether they are representative of all people. But racial gerrymandering, the court stays away from. So, Jim, we've watched this as journalists change dramatically in the Roberts Court.
Right. I mean, there was a time when the Justice Department had a very robust civil rights division, and who ran that division was extremely important. One thing about the Voting Rights Act of 65 is that all challenges, all these pre-clearance challenges, they were run through the D.C. courts, because mm-hmm. the people of the day didn't trust the federal judges on the ground in the Deep South.
All right, let's do this. We've begun moving towards Supreme Court, so let's keep going in that direction when we come back. But I also want to talk about this feud that seems to be growing between John Ossoff and Brian Kemp over who ought to get credit for Georgia becoming such a major player in the world of alternative energy and electric vehicles. We'll do that and more after these messages.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Tanya Washington, Fred Smith, Anthony Michael Christ, and Jim Galloway join us for our show. We're going to talk, since we have three professors of law on the show today, three who I admire enormously and I'm glad are with us, and my partner Jim Galloway, former AJC political columnist, all with us today. Let's look at the cases that we imagine are going to be released by the court over the period, say the next 48 hours as they come to the end of June. Tanya, the one of the most important, of course, has to do with using race as a criteria in college admissions. The case comes from the University of North Carolina, a public institution, and Harvard, which is interesting, I think, in and of itself. We're talking about both public and private universities. And I want to read you just a paragraph, the lead graph from a New York Times report on the day the court heard arguments in this case and what those arguments and the way the justices reacted to them seemed to perhaps hint at what was going to come. This is Adam Liptak's piece. The Supreme Court on Monday appeared ready to rule that the race-conscious admissions programs at Harvard and the University of North Carolina were unlawful based on questioning over 5 hours of vigorous and sometimes testy arguments, a move that would overrule decades of precedents. Tanya, this is a very important case, and it's one that you all, as professors at universities, have got to be watching very closely.
Absolutely. And it's two cases. One, as you said, North Carolina will focus on public universities and Harvard on private institutions. And it's an area of research that has been kind of the focus of my scholarship for the past 20 years. I worked, did some work on the Michigan versus Grutter case out of Michigan, University of Michigan, where the court embraced the use of race in service of diversity, which is one aspect of educational diversity. And I do believe that the court is poised, not just based on the oral arguments that you referenced in the passage you read, but also just based on the opinions since the Grutter decision in 2003 up until now, that many on the court and a majority of the court is poised to invalidate the continued use of race. And I'm concerned as a professor in terms of what that means for what my classrooms look like. If you don't have Black and brown and Indigenous undergraduate students, you don't have Black and brown and Indigenous law students, graduate students, engineers, lawyers, judges, teachers, dentists, doctors. So you could wipe out, you know, an entire professional class of people. And I think that would be devastating for our society.
Fred, I want to bring you and Anthony in, but let me read you just a couple of the comments from justices on the day these cases were heard. Not surprisingly, Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito seemed the most skeptical. At one point, Justice Thomas said, quote, "I've heard the word diversity quite a few times, and I don't have a clue what it means. It seems to mean everything for everyone." And Justice Alito said that he answered, "What does that mean when you talk about underrepresented minorities?" He added that college admissions are a zero-sum game in which granting advantages to one group necessarily disadvantages another. So the question becomes, are they going to find enough of their colleagues who will join them in what clearly is going to be a dissent, I would think, on their part, Fred?
Yeah, I mean, here's the reality. There are more qualified folks who apply for slots at highly selective institutions than there are places, right? So so you have, in fact, far more, far more. And so what admissions officers then are also looking to, in addition to whether someone has the academic qualifications to succeed, they're looking to things like, do we have representation for all from all 50 states? Do we have a lot of international representation? Because we know what that means to the classroom learning experience. Are we making sure that we have representation in the way of gender, et cetera? And so far, over the last 40 years or so, they've also considered whether or not it's a racially diverse class, right? And what the Supreme Court is poised to do is to conclude that it is unconstitutional to engage in that last kind of diversification. The rest would remain the same, but intentionally racially integrating one's class would be unconstitutional. And yes, there will be undoubtedly a dissent, as there have been in the prior cases. And I'll say, you know, about 10 years ago, the Supreme Court was poised to eradicate affirmative action. And according to Joan Biskupic, a dissent by Justice Sotomayor was so strong that it persuaded the court to, in a consensus 8-1 opinion, push that for another day. And so it survived 11 years longer than it otherwise would have, but I don't think anyone thinks that it's going to survive any more years.
Jim, before I bring Anthony in to continue the conversation about the implications of this from a legal, constitutional point of view, let me put it in the context of Georgia. You were a student at the University of Georgia. It was in 1961, in January of 1961, that Hamilton Holmes and Charlene Hunter desegregated for the first time the University of Georgia. It was met, of course, with on one side celebration, on the other side demonstrations against the admission of Black students to the university. And I mention that today because the university that you attended was far different from what the one was in 1960 before those two came in. You were there with diverse students, and I wonder how that shaped your university experience.
Well, I would take a little bit of an issue with that. I mean, that was you're right. January 61 was when it was formally integrated. There were riots. There was a huge riot, in response, and it, that kind of pushed Ernest Vandiver, the governor, to back off his no not one pledge. I started at the University of Georgia about a dozen years later, and I think maybe 4 or 5% of the student population was African American. Athens still has a tough time attracting minority students. It's not where it ought to be, given where the state is. It is nowhere near. If African Americans make up 30% of the total population, it's nowhere close to that in the student population. So it remains a work in progress.
So that surprises me. I did not realize that, but you, having gone to Georgia, would get that. So, Anthony, that makes a ruling. Just you take the University of Georgia example that Jim's talking about struggling. Anthony, that makes this ruling by the court, adds even more weight to it.
I think we, as a society, will have to have a very deep introspective moment about college admissions and how all this process will work out going forward once the court makes its decision. One of the things that we can't not talk about at some point is that one of the greatest forms of affirmative action that we have in this country is legacy admissions, which benefit those who are already privileged, right? That they are second, third, fourth generation college graduates at that point, many of them, and yet they get a benefit, that is clearly important to their identity, right? If and when I ever have children, I would love my children to go to UNC or to UGA, right? As I'm an alum of both. That's an important identity marker for many families. We have to ask a question, and of course, this also depends on how the court makes its decision. Why can't people who have very strong feelings about their racial identity, their religious identity, their sexual orientation, their gender identity, where they're from, the state, rural, urban, whatever, why can't they express that as being important to them and having that be part of the admissions process in a way that legacy admissions have continued to benefit many people? And I don't know how that's all going to play out. I don't know how the court is on the one hand going to say you can't consider race, but then also how do you stop people from voluntarily admitting or voluntarily providing that information? How does that work? What are the implications for admissions essays and the like? I mean, it's an administrative nightmare depending on how the court renders its decision. And I think that, on the one hand, the court is really against any kind of thing that smells of race consciousness. On the other hand, it's the kind of dominoes that are going to fall and the kind of administrative headaches that are going to emerge from how the court makes its decision on this case, I think are going to be very problematic for administrators. And again, I think there's got to be a broader social conversation to be had.
Tanya, finish us off on this subject.
Yes, I Anthony's point is well taken. And I think Justice Jackson, in her questioning, talked about how can we consider legacy as relevant to admissions, but not some of these other equally important, and I would argue more important, signifiers. But I also want to say that this opinion, while it will be made in the context of race and admissions, may, in the same way that Brown did, have implications beyond colleges and universities. Brown was just about K through 12, but then it ended up kind of fueling the desegregation of other spaces. And I feel like in kind of an inverse way, in a similar way, this decision will have implications for employment and other spaces where race continues to be a relevant consideration. And I think it really just depends on how broadly or narrowly the decision is written. But I will predict it will be a long decision.
Okay. Thank you, Todd. You get the last word in this segment of Political Rewind. Back with more in just a moment. Jim Galloway, you just sent us a note. Do very quickly, because it relates to the last segment in affirmative action, just give us a real quick summary of what you, the data you've pulled on degrees at, in universities in Georgia.
Yeah, and this is of 2020. The student population at the University of Georgia was 67% white, 9.5% Asian, 8.2% Black or African American, and then Hispanics, Hispanic and or Latino. So it's still dominated very much by white demographics here.
What I've loved about being able to host this show over the last 9 years is how much I learn, in addition to what I know all of you out there as listeners tell me you learn about it too. Thank you, Jim Galloway. I did not realize that was the situation at Georgia. All right, Anthony, another big case that we're waiting for is basically it can frame it as the rights of LGBTQ individuals as opposed to free speech. It's a case that comes out of Littleton, Colorado, where a woman who is a web designer has made it clear she does not want to do her work for LGBTQ couples who are coming to her to do websites for their upcoming weddings. And we don't have any clue, do we, as to how the court might rule on which is dominant, free speech or the rights of LGBTQ people?
The tea leaf reading is always hard to do, but it's easier as the court starts to issue its very last opinions. If we're looking at the kind of case assignments and when the decision or when the cases were heard in oral argument, most court watchers, myself included, seem to believe that Justice Gorsuch is the most likely candidate to have the majority opinion here, in which case it is incredibly dim news for LGBTQ advocates who are very worried about how this case might get decided. Ultimately, the court will have to decide, whether or not this public accommodations law applied in this way. And again, and I do want to note that nobody asked this particular plaintiff to actually violate her free speech rights. This is all kind of a manufactured crisis from my personal perspective. But the court will have to decide whether or not at the application of Colorado's public accommodation law in such a way would violate her free speech rights. I think that the real question here is not so much what the outcome is going to be, but what the contours of the actual decision are, because it can be very broad and sweeping. It can be very narrow. We've seen in cases before, like in the case out of Philadelphia about adoption law or adoption regulations, and we've seen it before in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, which was a religious claim, not a free speech claim. But we've seen before in these instances where these different interests clash that the court has kind of backed away from very broad sweeping decisions and has made very narrow ones. So I think that's the real question for me, is the scope and not so much the outcome. I think she's going to ultimately win this case.
Well, Fred, Anthony mentions the Masterpiece case, and it's interesting because in that case where the baker refused to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple, also out of Colorado, the court didn't rule in a broad enough way to eliminate this issue that's now before them in this case, which is, Anthony points out, is about free speech, not that baker's religious convictions.
Yeah, so in the Masterpiece case, what the court said was that the decision makers, the people who fined the baker, acted with religious animosity. And here, no one has acted against this web designer. No one even asked her to design a website. She preemptively went to court. So there's the facts are different. So there's no one to say, to look to and say they were violating my religious rights, because she wasn't even asked to make a website in the first place. So this then is a case about free speech. She says that she doesn't want to be compelled to design a website I guess it, so a lot will be depend factually on what, again, as Anthony said, on what they precisely say. Is this a how much do they say about the level of creative art that goes into her designing the website? And how much will this then apply instead to things that are what they call plug and play, where you just type in, this is my name, this is my whatever, and then it spits out a website. Anyone who's gotten married recently has used one of these websites, RSVPify and the like. You just plug it in, right? And we certainly don't want an opinion that says that you can just plug it in and it spits back, that sounds like a male name, and that sounds like a male name. You can't do this. This is like, so a lot depends on exactly what they say. And we will know either in an hour or tomorrow at about 10:30. We'll have a better sense of just how broadly they're choosing a rule.
Jim, I know you want to jump back in, and then Tanya, I want to get your take on this.
Actually, just a question for Tanya or Fred or for Anthony. How common is it for a case to get to the Supreme Court where there is no harm done to the plaintiff? That the harm is that the case is theoretical. That sounds rather British to me.
Tanya, it does raise Anthony... the question of standing. All right,
yeah, Anthony. I'm going to let Anthony give a more specific answer, but my short answer is more often than they should.
Well, even the decision the other day from on the independent state legislature doctrine, I mean, in theory, nobody had a case or controversy at issue, because the North Carolina Supreme Court had reversed the decision that got it to the Supreme Court in the first place. Now, normally the court should kick that out, but you know, the court here said, no, we're going to go forward with this anyway. So I'm not really, you know, it certainly happens more often than, you know, in theory it should happen, but it certainly does happen.
Mm-hmm. Tanya, we're a little short on time. Well, go ahead, Tanya.
I just wanted to say that, you know, this case raises the broader question, whether you can call your speech non-discriminatory just by asserting that it is protected by the First Amendment, even if it has an adverse and discriminatory effect on, in this case, LGBTQ folks and community.
Tanya, one of the other cases we're waiting for a decision on is whether President Biden has the right to relieve students of their loan debt, or whether he overstepped his boundaries on that. What's your sense of why is that case? Well, I know why it's important to all the students with loan debt, but what are the basic questions in that case?
Well, students are waiting with bated breath because the loans will resume their due date, I believe, as of September. But I'm going to kick the description of the case to my colleagues, Anthony and Fred, for a fuller description.
Fred?
Well, under the HEROES Act, the Department of Education has the ability to, quote, modify or waive student loan rules. And so the question is whether or not the decision that they made in this particular case to pause student loans, whether or not that falls within that language. It may run into this doctrine that the court created a few years ago called the major questions doctrine, where anything that's a major question, the Congress has to endorse with specificity. It's a brand new rule, and we don't know exactly how it's going to play out.
Jim, this is one of the biggest political matters that President Biden has weighed in on. He made it a campaign promise long ago. He finally pulled the trigger, and he's been met with enormous pushback, political pushback, certainly from Republicans. And now, of course, the courts will decide the matter.
Right. And you have to wonder, part of me wonders whether Biden announced this policy with the knowledge that this might happen. But he had to push, put the idea out there anyway, in any case. I mean, this is extremely important to people who have been told time and time again that college is the ticket to success in America. And yet states are not paying for it anymore.
Yeah. Anthony, as we run out of time, I really want to get your take on this.
Well, the the threshold issue in this case, too, is this standing question, right? Who is actually harmed by the forgiveness of these loans? Do the states that some of them hold these loan servicing companies, are they injured? There's a number of folks who had loans forgiven that claim that they've been injured because now they'll be taxed on the forgiveness, although they could technically decline the forgiveness. So that's the threshold question. But I also think, once again, that this goes back to a bigger question. Yes, these loans are deeply problematic. Yes, I think forgiveness personally is a great thing and more should be done. But the costs of higher ed are just tremendous because in part the states have just refused to fund it in the way that they used to. And we really need to get back to that.
All right. Anthony Michael Christ gets the final word in today's Political Rewind. I loved having a panel of law professors today. Anthony, thank you. Fred Smith, your long service to this show has been really a wonderful thing. And Tanya Washington, it's a great pleasure to have you as well. Jim Galloway, we will meet again somewhere to talk about politics. I'm sure of it, my friend. In the meantime, this is it. We're tomorrow. Final Political Rewind before we close the doors and move on. And Natalie Mendenhall, Chase McGee, Victoria Evans Cash, and Buddha are all looking forward to that show tomorrow. So come on, watch, listen with us as we say goodbye here at GPB. That's it for us today. Back again, as I said, tomorrow. Until then, take care, stay healthy, and yes, be good to one another. Bye, everybody.